The situation in Ukraine continues to deteriorate or improve, depending on which side of the conflict one stands. Is the annexation of Crimea and the demise of the order in Ukraine the first real threat to a Europe in peace? Or is it a reaction to warnings by Russia, not heeded by the West? My guest today to discuss this issue with listeners of the Foreign Policy Association is Dr. Rajan Menon, who is widely considered to be an authority on the subject. He is the Anne and Bernard Spitzer Professor of Political Science at the Powell School, City College of New York, and a senior research scholar at the Salzman Institute of War and Peace Studies, Columbia University. His latest book, Conflict in Ukraine, co-authored with Eugene Rumer of the Carnegie Endowment, was published last month by MIT Press. My conversation with Dr. Menon. So, Mr. Menon, let's start by asking you, there is this current feeling that Mr. Putin is singularly responsible for what's taking place, and that he is a revanchist, and that he wants to take Russia back to the Tsarist days.
I think it's a bit of an exaggeration. This is not to bestow any favors on Mr. Putin or the name or the nature of his regime. But I think as he sees it, and as a good many people in Russia see it, it's actually a mistake to believe that he had no political support in Russia. They see it as follows, that Soviet Union collapsed, and that of all the post-Soviet states, by virtue of its size and cultural kinship and location on the western gates of Russia, there is no more important post-Soviet republic than Ukraine.
Right.
And as they see it, over time, the goal of the West has been to move Ukraine out of its orbit and attach it to two separate organizations, the European Union and NATO.
Yep.
Now, I don't want to get into the question of whether this is fact or not, but it is important to understand that this view is not total fabrication. It is the basis upon which the Russians perceive this conflict. And therefore, not surprisingly, when Yanukovych, the pro-Soviet leader who had been, pro-Russian leader who had been ruling Ukraine until last spring was overthrown.
Right.
The Russians did not see this in the way that the West saw. They saw it as an event that was orchestrated by the West, and they believed that for all of his faults, Yanukovych had, after all, won an election that had been internationally certified.
Indeed.
They then reacted by essentially suborning a referendum in Ukraine, and then aiding separatists in Russia's east, both in Crimea and in the parts of eastern Ukraine that are now battling the central government. There has always been a disagreement between these areas and Ukraine on what Ukraine's foreign and domestic trajectory ought to be.
Do you think the active support by American diplomats during the Maidan opposition, do you think that added more fuel to the fire?
No question, but you know, let's be clear that in all previous elections, there has been a contest in which the West and Russia have tried in various ways to influence the outcome.
Uh-huh.
And whereas a lot of Western NGOs are involved in this process and have been, I don't think the Russians see them as completely separate from the activities of the American government. Again, that is the Russian view. When a senior member of Obama's administration went to Kiev, and was recorded by Russian intelligence speaking on an open line to our ambassador here discussing the composition of the Ukrainian government.
Yes.
Who ought to and who ought not to be in the government that succeeded Yanukovych. That simply fed the Russian suspicion that this was an orchestrated move by the United States.
Do you think that in this instance, the United States ought to let the European Union, that is right next door to what's happening, take the leadership role, but basically leave the driving to the European Union?
I know that you yourself have advocated this, and I think it's a sensible recommendation for a number of reasons. First, Europeans are exposed to this, the fallout of this war, in a way that we simply are not. They have a much stronger trade relationship with Russia than we have had. They do about 10 times the amount of trade with Russia. There are voices in Germany in particular that have always argued about the eventual need to mend fences with Russia. But much more importantly, there's much less electricity involved in a negotiation in which, say, Hollande, the French president, and Merkel, the German chancellor, are the main interlocutors, and we stay in the sidelines. If there's any hope for a political settlement, I think it'll come along those lines. I'm not saying you should do nothing. But this is a case where I would leave, as you put it, the driving to the Europeans.
Ukraine itself, there are questions as to whether that state can ever be self-supporting and whether it should, in fact, become an independent, standalone state because of its historical context with Russia. You have any thoughts on that?
Yes. I in fact, think that there can be a viable, independent Ukraine along the territories that it now controls. That said, what worries me much more than the war that's continuing is whether the economy will collapse.
Hmm.
The Ukrainians now have in their coffers enough money to cover barely a month and a half to 2 months of exports. This year alone, they owe creditors something like $7 or $8 billion.
Wow.
Their currency has plummeted. Their economy has, the currency has lost about 50% of its value against the dollar over the last year. And the economy has contracted by like almost close to 8% in the past. So on top of that, they have to do these reforms mandated by the IMF and the West. And so the real question is, can they pay their debts? And can they embark on an austerity program? And if the economy doesn't stabilize, what are the political consequences?
Two more questions, Professor Menon. The first one is, there is a feeling that because of the so-called Budapest Agreement, that the United States must come to the defense of Ukraine because America was party to the negotiations to get Ukraine to dispose of their nuclear weapons. Two, related to the first point, is that people say the Budapest agreements require the United States, if there ever is a nuclear threat, for the U.S. to come to the aid of Ukraine. Do you agree with both those points?
Well, to the extent that the Budapest Agreement is not a binding treaty that imposes specific defense obligations on the United States, I would say that those who are making this argument are making a rather curious argument.
Hmm.
Besides, the question is not whether we must come to the defense of Ukraine. There's no legal obligation equivalent to Article 4 of NATO. It should we. And there are two ways to look at this. On the economic front, we can do much. You know, we haven't really done all that much so far. $2 billion or so, far less money than the Ukrainians can use. The question of whether we ought to arm the Ukrainians raises a serious question. The Ukrainian army is a ramshackle. There are numerous privately warlord-funded militias in Ukraine's east. And there are two questions. One is monitoring the flow of American weapons and making sure that they stay in the right hand and for the right purpose. Much more fundamentally, Plan B. What happens if the Ukrainian army, despite being trained and equipped by the United States, fails because the Russians simply escalate the conflict, which they can much more easily do than we can? What is our plan? Do we get dragged into a confrontation with Russia on its doorstep? And it seems to me that those who have advocated arming Ukraine have not thought through this very carefully.
You've been listening to a conversation with Professor Rajan Menon on behalf of the Foreign Policy Association. This is Sarwar Kashmiri. Thank you for listening.